Hello and welcome to the lies.com podcast for Thursday, June 15th, I want to say. It's been a good week for George Bush, so I will honor his achievements with a mention on the podcast. According to Gallup, he has climbed out of the low 30s and is up around 38 in terms of presidential approval. Al-Zarqawi was blown up by some 500-pound bombs delivered by the U.S. military. And Bush showed up in Baghdad for a surprise visit, the first and only visit he's made there since he showed up by surprise to walk around with the centerpiece turkey at a mess hall. He showed up for a five-hour visit to the Green Zone, snuck in and out in order to avoid getting killed, which I can certainly understand. And Karl Rove got good news. According to Robert Luskin, Rove's lawyer, Patrick Fitzgerald has told him that he will not be indicted as part of the Plame outing investigation. Now, Luskin, of course, made lots of hay about that, and the Ken Melman at the Republican National Committee immediately jumped into the news with a statement that this showed that, of course, this was just the Democrats being obsessed with vindictive gotcha politics, that it proved that Karl Rove was innocent all along. And it was interesting that, Luskin didn't offer any details other than to say that Fitzgerald had told him that Rove would not be indicted. And then, the Bush side of the team, the Bush team went out to make as much hay out of that as they could. It's still not very clear at all what actually took place there. I think the fairest interpretation at this point, in light of what we actually know, is that the Plame outing was really orchestrated by Dick Cheney, and Karl Rove's involvement in it, at least his direct involvement in it, was minimal. And while Rove was certainly, if you take the administration's statements at face value, if you take the statements of Scott McClellan, the press secretary, at face value, then Rove clearly lied, albeit apparently not under oath, at least not in a provable way. But according to McClellan, Rove told him that absolutely he wasn't involved. Dick Cheney's said that he wasn't involved, according to Scott McClellan. And I think it's clear in hindsight that Dick Cheney was very much involved. We have evidence of that just in the little tidbits that have come out in the court filings. And, of course, Scooter Libby is, Cheney's top aide, is still under indictment, and his trial will start, I think, in January. So they pushed that out beyond the 2006 elections, for which I'm sure Republicans everywhere are happy. But in any event, if you put that all together, what you end up with is a very good week for George Bush. Seeing him grinning in the photo op in Baghdad, it really brought home to me this notion. I mean, we've seen that look before. That's the same grin he had during the flight deck appearance on the Abraham Lincoln, where he flew in on the jet for his mission accomplished speech. It's the same grin we saw at the Thanksgiving visit to Baghdad, where he walked around with the turkey. It's that grin that he gets when he's really enjoying his presidential stature. He's really enjoying the job. He's getting to do something really fun that he likes. He gets to play president. He gets to play leader. You know, it's not like the normal run-of-the-mill day-to-day stuff where again, by all evidence, although we don't have direct evidence since they work very hard to conceal this reality, but by all evidence, Dick Cheney is really the man running the government on a day-to-day basis, running the executive branch. He's the one making the hard decisions, doing the extent that it's happening, doing the policy analysis. You know, he's the one who went to the CIA and camped out there and pushed people to get the intelligence they wanted to make the Iraq war happen. He's the one who went on Meet the Press on the eve of the war and just gave a string of, wild exaggerations and lies. I'm sure they're lies. I mean, you can call them mistakes if you want, mistaken judgment. But it was an act of political spin, and, that there wouldn't be an insurgency, and Shinseki was wrong about the number of troops we'd need to control the country. We'd be greeted as liberators, and yada, 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 yada. Dick Cheney is really at the heart of what's bad about the Bush presidency. Bush just plays president on TV. And occasionally when he gets to do a, you know, an easy photo op, easy in the sense that, he doesn't have to answer a bunch of tough questions, he just gets to make a speech that really resonates with his sense of how he'd like to see himself. You know, the macho stuff about America stands by its word and doesn't cut and run, and the stuff he was able to say to, the new Iraqi prime minister in Baghdad. Bush clearly enjoys that a great deal. So, good week for George Bush. And Rove, in the wake of his getting the good news about his non-indictment, went out and made a fire and brimstone speech that made it clear that the Republican playbook for the 2006 campaign is to push hard on Iraq. They're going to make Iraq. They have the gall to make Iraq the centerpiece of their campaign. And it'll probably work, you know, and looking at what the Democrats have in response, Rove is playing up the notion that, look, we have a strategy. We have a firm commitment to doing what's right. Republicans are wishy-washy. The Republicans are like, you know, John Kerry tacking back and forth on the windsurfer. You've got some of them saying immediate pullout, some of them saying, no, we have to stay. And they're going to exploit that. And in the wake of all that, they'll make it clear that, I mean, it's completely Rovian and Bushian, the strategy they're taking, and they've done it again and again, to make the failure, the colossal failure and incompetence of their team's decision-making that led us into the quagmire that is Iraq today, where we have no good options, where we're spending the country into bankruptcy in order to conduct this war, we're bringing home thousands of dead American soldiers and many thousands more permanently disabled or horrifically injured, brain damaged, amputees, just this awful ongoing carnage. And all of that for no particularly good reason, since everything we set out to achieve in making the, in invading Iraq has arguably failed or turned out to not be necessary. So in the midst of this horrendous failure, this colossal failure, any way you analyze it, they're going to run on that. They're going to aggressively make how terrible the situation is now the test for who you want to have in office, because it is legitimately a frightening prospect that we face in Iraq. They'll play upon the fears and the democratic disagreements, because the Democrats are actually grappling with the issue. Because there are Democrats who've actually moved beyond the craven, self-serving political calculation of supporting the war because they knew it was popular. Because some of them have actually come out now and said, no, this war is a bad idea and we should end it. And the damage that we're doing is not going to be made worse by pulling out. It's going to be, you know, the situation will be made better. Because you've got that happening, because they're honestly trying to solve this terrible problem Bush has created, the dishonest party will win. The dishonest party will go out and say, no, we've got to stand tall, stay the course. So we'll see if that resonates with the voters. At this point, you know, in the wake of the 2004 presidential election, I've got no reason to think it won't resonate with the voters. But we'll see. We'll see if some real leadership emerges on the other side. Enough about politics. The reason I'm recording this podcast today, a Thursday, rather than on Friday, which is what I typically do, is that I know tomorrow I won't be going into work. I'm taking a vacation day tomorrow, and I'm doing that so that I can go to the rites of passage ceremony, signifying Julia's graduation from the Santa Barbara Middle School. And I don't know how much I've talked about the school on the podcast before. I did talk briefly way back in podcast one, I think, where I talked about Troy and Josh, the two kids from actually they're not both from them, but one of them is from a private Christian school in, I believe, South Carolina. And these are the two kids that got swept out to sea on in essence, a little raft, I mean, a little sailboat with no sails, and ended up spending some large number of days at sea, 5 days, I want to say, not sure. Had this big adventure. I posted about it on lies.com and talked about it in the podcast. and got into it a little bit. You know, I've got a bit of a seafaring background myself, and many aspects of the story really struck me as noteworthy. But the one thing I talked about that I'm reminded of now is I talked about the school that I think it's Troy goes to, whichever one is the younger one, the younger one with the sort of blonde page boy haircut, goes to this private Christian school. And I had gone and I'd read through the school's philosophy and looked at their website and made the point that by teaching him to believe a lot of stupid things, you know, dogmatic aspects of fundamentalist Christianity about like creationism and faith healing and things like that, that they had ill-prepared Troy, or Josh, can't remember, I'm sorry guys, they had ill-prepared him for this ordeal, and in fact put him in the situation where he got into this ordeal, because he's not used to thinking for himself, he's used to being told what to do. So when they made this bad decision to try and paddle across to this little island for some fishing and got swept out to sea by the current, both of them basically immediately just lay down and waited to die, waited for God to take them, and prayed and sang hymns, and spent 4 or 5 days drifting slowly, you know, north along the coast, when in fact, if on any of these days they'd simply paddled for shore, they would have been able to rescue themselves. They weren't that far offshore. They just had to paddle west. You know, they just had to do some basic navigation, but instead they speculated about whether that land over there is Africa, and I don't know, just really were not exactly poster children for educational excellence, private school style. But it put me in mind of the private school my daughter attends, because she's been going to private school these last 4 years, and the Santa Barbara Middle School has this great program where they really try and get the kids through this transitional period. The founder of the school, who since has gone on and founded a school in New Zealand, so he's not around anymore, but his spirit very much infuses the school and its philosophy and its programs. Kent Ferguson is his name. Never met him, but everyone talks about him at the school. The basic philosophy was that, you know, kids are going through this transitional stage during the middle school years, like 6th through 9th grade is what the school covers. And they're making this fundamental transition from being dependent children to being responsible young adults. And yeah, arguably that process continues through high school and even beyond then. But if you look at what the nexus of the most dramatic change is, that's the transition. And you can see it. I mean, they're going through puberty. I mean, they're physically becoming adult, at least biologically. And there is this fundamental shift that kids go through, that I remember going through. That's a very difficult transition, and everybody's been through it who's listening to this, or is it, you know, conceivably is going through it, so everybody knows how significant it is. And the philosophy of the school, the approach of the school, is to take the kids and test them. You know, it's sort of an outward bound style program that they run, where they take the kids on bicycle trips. You know, the kid has, every student in the school goes on these trips, and you have a mountain bike, and they go camping, and they go out for 4 or 5 days at a time, and they teach them self-reliance, and they challenge them. You know, they teach them to go beyond what they think they can do. It's really a remarkable program, and it's, you know, as I've seen it for the past 4 years, it absolutely works. You know, occasionally it doesn't work. They've had problems with kids where they take them and kids have to leave the school or choose to leave the school. But for those who stay and go through the program, I'm just amazingly impressed, and I'm impressed with what it's done for Julia. You know, we were really, as parents, we were really in a state of near panic when Julia was going through like 4th and 5th grade. She's very mentally gifted academically. She was reading at a 5th grade level when she was in 1st grade, that kind of thing. As you know, we're both Linda and I, so I don't know if that's an argument in favor of the biological component of that sort of ability. And you know, certainly we raised her in an environment that encouraged that sort of thing too, so you can make the argument either way. Anyway, she had this, and as I came to appreciate, especially back during that interval when we were active in the local public school system in forming a parents group for GATE, which is the California Gifted and Talented Education Program. It's like the what I remember as a kid of being the mentally gifted minor program. It's like the gifted program that the state puts these days just a tiny token amount of money into. But what I realized in working with that, working on that group and researching the relationship between highly gifted children and the public educational system, is that it really is a problem that these kids are so gifted. And yeah, it's a problem that I'm happy that I have as a parent, and it's a problem that I wouldn't trade away, but it nevertheless does represent a problem. You've got this kid who's reading at a fifth grade level, who's writing at a, fourth grade level in first grade. So what are you going to do with that kid? You're going to put that kid in a first grade classroom, and she's going to sit there and be bored as information that she already knows is explained slowly for the benefit of the kids in the class who don't already understand it. And to the extent you get a good teacher who can differentiate the curriculum, who can, give those kids who are able to go farther extension opportunities and help actually motivate them and assist them in doing that. And to the extent your teacher has time for that sort of thing, based on class size and other challenges that might exist in the classroom regarding other kids who fall outside the mainstream, you can have a situation where that gets dealt with relatively effectively. But it was a struggle. And as parents, it was a constant struggle trying to find a situation that where Julia could get her needs met and the teacher could get his or her needs met. Because, you bore a student like Julia, as she was in fourth and fifth grade, and she's going to create disruptions. She's a very active kid. She's, going to use that mind of hers. She's like the genie in the Arab fable. If you don't give him that, you don't give her that curly hair to constantly straighten out, she's going to eat you alive. She's going to take up all of your available time with having to manage her boredom. And so it was problematic. And all of Julia's teachers in elementary school made what I would describe as a game effort, to do right by her. And I certainly appreciate that as a parent. But by the time Julia was in fourth grade, we had this issue. She was in fourth grade. I'm trying to remember what the exact timing was. But during the interval of fourth grade and fifth grade, a lot of stuff went on in her life. She had her heart surgery that I've talked about in a previous podcast and the recuperation from that, which took a long time. And she ended up in a situation where she was getting, in effect, she got the fifth grade curriculum her fourth grade year. And then it was really playing out in fifth grade like she was going to be getting the fifth grade curriculum again, which was really just kiss of death. It was going to be, as obsessive monitors of her educational, the challenges she was getting and the progress she was making, that was really going to be problematic. So we pulled Julia out of the public school and started homeschooling her. And so for the last half of her fifth grade year, Linda and I homeschooled her. And, academically, that, I think, helped. It allowed her to kind of get back on track with some of the subjects where she'd been sort of checking out. But it was also a really difficult process for both Linda and me. And we were definitely looking for an alternative. And the Santa Barbara Middle School ended up providing that alternative. So, and academically, besides this whole TRIP program and the maturation process and inculcating a sense of responsibility in the kids, they also are excellent from an academic standpoint. The large majority of the teachers there are amazing teachers. And as someone who, worked in the public school system as a long-term substitute for a couple of years, right way back when I first got out of college, I think I've got a pretty good sense of the challenges that teachers face and can evaluate the different approaches they take to those to teaching. And the very large majority of the teachers Julia's had at the middle school are fantastic teachers. Class sizes are small. I mean, this is one of the things you buy with the private school tuition, which has been tough for us to pay. And Julia's going to school with some students who are very wealthy and, for whom that's not an issue. And that ends up raising other issues like, gee, Mom and Dad, why aren't we going to Hawaii on spring break? Why aren't we going to Switzerland over Easter? It's like, well, Julia, because we're putting you through this school and that's where that money is going. But one of the things you buy is smaller class sizes and the ability to kind of, find exactly the program you think is right for your kid. And we definitely have found that in the Santa Barbara Middle School. It's amazing to me to see the transition Julia's gone through, and I'm just completely satisfied with the job they've done there at the middle school. Anyway, why did I bring this all up? Oh, because tomorrow is the rites of passage ceremony, which is the graduation ceremony for the outgoing ninth graders. And as you'd expect, given the whole emphasis they have at the school, its whole philosophy, they make a big deal out of this graduation. And there's something like 40 kids, I think, in the class who are graduating. And each kid gets to select a speaker, a person to speak on their behalf at the ceremony. And I was honored by Julia selecting me to speak on her behalf. So I've been working on my speech. It's kind of funny having both Linda and Julia kind of tell me, oh yes, we know you'll do a great job in the speech. We know you'll do a great job. But at the same time, their anxiety, they can't conceal their anxiety as they ask me, well, you know, if you're going to make a joke, make sure that it's a funny one. It's like they're just, and I had this whole, I basically had it out with both of them last night. Linda came to me and said, oh, Julia's nervous about your speech. You really should talk to her and reassure her. So I talked to her, and it was more that, well, Linda and Julia are both nervous about the speech, and they're egging each other on to talk to me about it. But what I ended up saying is, look, you know, yes, I'm taking it seriously. Yes, I've been working hard on trying to prepare myself while not over-preparing. I'm going to make the best speech I can make for you, Julia. But short of actually delivering it to you now, and given that you really are the intended target of this 2-minute talk I'm going to give, I don't want to tell you in advance. It would be dishonest at the event to have you sitting there listening to this communication from me and have you already have heard it. You know, and it's a little bit selfish on my part too. It's like the line in Tolkien about when is it? It's in The Return of the King when Frodo is wondering what all these preparations in Minas Tirith mean, and Gandalf is explaining that it's a secret, and the chefs who've been preparing the meal, I think that's the part of the book that it comes from, the chefs who've been preparing the meal don't like to give away what's going to be included on the menu because that makes the words of praise louder. And it's just this notion that, you know, I've worked hard on writing this little speech I'm going to give, and I'm working, you know, doing my best to make it effective. But, you know, so I don't want to give it away in advance. And, I mean, I was bringing up, like, look, honestly, guys, I appreciate your telling me you're confident, but by going after me about this now, you're basically communicating the exact opposite. So, you know, I'm prepared to do the speech. I'll do the best I can. You're just going to have to wait and see. And, you know, and then I teased him a little bit. I talked about, oh, maybe I'll give it in my pajamas. Or I don't know what I was saying, but anyway. So tomorrow I get to give that speech. So that's my big excitement for tomorrow and the reason why I'm podcasting on Thursday. You know, after that build-up, I guess I could practice the speech now for the podcast, which would be a good step for me in terms of, you know, I've been working on it and delivering the speech in the car as I drive to and from work and timing it. And, you know, again, 2 minutes isn't very long. A lot of material had to be cut out. But I guess this is another step along the transition. You know, this is a little bit like delivering it to an audience, since I'm speaking it with the pressure of actually delivering it to someone who will eventually hear it, assuming anyone listens to my podcast. And since it won't come out, since I won't be putting this podcast out until after the event itself, I don't have to worry about it stealing my thunder. Not that either Linda or Julia listens to this podcast, at least as far as I know. So I'll go ahead and make my speech. The first time I rode Disney's Hollywood Tower of Terror ride, I was sitting next to my daughter Julia, and it made for a very memorable experience. The ride itself is very exciting. You're on this runaway freight elevator, and it zooms up and plunges down and up and down. And there's my favorite part towards the end of the ride, where you zoom all the way up to the top of the tower, and the doors suddenly open in front of you to reveal this amazing view with all of Southern California spread out below you. But for me, the most memorable thing about that ride was the experience of being strapped into the seat next to someone with a remarkable set of lungs and a willingness to use them to the fullest possible extent. And that's Julia. Remarkable abilities combined with an intensity, with a willingness to apply those abilities, that's truly awe-inspiring. To share just one memory I have of Julia's time at the middle school, a few years back on a fall trip, on the next to the last day, she had a bad fall off her bicycle and had to be taken to the hospital and get stitches. Seeing her ride her bike into the homecoming the next day, bandaged from head to foot, blood literally soaking through the bandages as she pedaled up the hill with a big grin on her face, that's a memory that I will cherish as long as I have memories. In thinking back on memories like that, on the skinny little sixth grader who came into the middle school 4 years ago, and in looking out today at the beautiful young woman that Julia has become, it's a reminder to me that I won't always be in the same elevator car with her. And in light of that, and I know now that I'm speaking for many of the people here today, I'd just like to say to you, Julia, what a privilege it's been to be strapped into the seat next to you. I'll never forget this ride. The heart-stopping plunges, the dizzying climbs, and the moments like this one, when there's a pause and the doors open in front of us to reveal the breathtaking view of the future that lies ahead of you. So that's my 2 minutes. And we'll see how it goes. I guess the closest thing I had to the experience Julie's had at the middle school was sailing. You know, right around the same time that I was going through those same years, I started really doing a lot of sailboat racing and did that through junior high and on through high school. Or most of the first couple of years of high school. After that, I pretty much stopped doing it. But racing on is a very similar experience. You know, going out there into the natural world, putting yourself in the path of difficulties and challenges, and physical challenges and mental challenges, teamwork challenges. You know, we were racing a 52-foot sailboat with a crew of like 8 to 12 people, and you know, so there was interpersonal dynamics going on there. Things you had to learn. And I've been thinking about that too, because actually I'm now planning to do some sailing on Victoria, on my dad's Columbia 52, the same sailboat that I had those experiences on. And I'm going to head down in about 3 weeks, well actually closer to 2 weeks now, head down to Mission Bay, where Victoria is currently docked, and bring the boat north to Channel Islands Harbor. So that'll take about a weekend, doing that trip up. And then the following weekend, I'm going to leave, at least the plan currently, is to leave for about 5 or 6 days over to Santa Cruz Island. Head over there with Linda and the kids and my brother-in-law Dick and sister-in-law Mary. And I'm not sure if anyone else is going on that trip, but that'll be a lot of fun. And then a few weeks after that, we're planning another trip with the same group plus Danny and Patricia. This is Linda's cousin, or second cousin, no, cousin, and Stephen, their son. So that should all be a lot of fun. And then sometime in August, I'll be taking the boat back down to San Diego. But you know, since I sold my boat, coming up on about 6 months ago now, I haven't done any sailing, and this will be a good opportunity to get back and do some of that. Looking forward to it a lot. I've been continuing my Keith and the Girl podcast obsession. Those guys are so prolific, I'm actually falling behind a little bit. You know, I basically have been trying to listen to them in two tracks. One is as I listen to the current podcast going forward, and I'm currently about two or three behind. And then as I have time, listening to their podcast from the beginning going forward. And I don't know, I'm going to have to start doing some more aggressive skimming or something, or get a longer commute, because it's... there's not enough hours in the day for me to listen to. If I just listened to them, it would allow me, I think, to catch up and eventually listen to all the old stuff too. But as entertaining as they are, you know, a steady diet of them for 3 hours a day is a little much. So I end up interspersing it with some of my other favorite podcasts, like Film Spotting, and there's a new Hollywood Saloon that's sitting waiting for me, waiting on my iPod for me to listen to, so I'll be listening to that soon. The thing I like about Keith and the Girls podcast, I think I've talked about this before, but there's this essential humanity to it, that they basically come off as nice people, and it's interesting to hear them talk. I mean, they're verbal, and they're funny, they're entertaining, and, you know, there's a level on which their relationship is really the star of the show. You know, it's clear that they love each other, and beneath the guise of Keith's, you know, misogynistic Andrew Dice Clay inspired talking smack that he does pretty much constantly, and her, you know, foul-mouthed response, it's, you can tell that beneath it all, they really do, they really are soulmates, and it's just great to hear them talking, and there's just these moments, you know, these moments of, there's these moments that remind me of the best part of my relationship with Linda, and it's just neat to hear them. You know, there was a show recently where Hemda was talking about Keith's dad, and you see this, I mean, this is kind of, you know, very evocative for me of my relationship with Linda. You know, we kind of healed each other, healed those injuries that we both carried from our childhood, this sense of injury at things we didn't like about how we were brought up or what was going on in our home situation when we were growing up. And, you know, I would voice outrage on Linda's behalf over the things that she experienced. And she does the same thing for me. She like says, well, look, you know, look how old you are. Look at this, look at that. You know, look at what you experienced here. Look how awful this was. And, you know, there's something very healing about that. Just because as a kid, you know, you end up arguing that everything you experienced is just the way things are. I mean, kids adapt to their situation no matter how horrible it is. And you find examples of other people who have it worse, and you tell yourself, you know, well, look, I didn't have it so bad. I mean, Jimmy over there had this going on at home or whatever. And it's just, you know, you have no perspective on that situation as a kid. And so you carry these scars, you carry these emotional scars of what you experienced when you were at this, you know, most vulnerable stage in your life. And having someone that you love and admire and respect, who will then be sort of in retrospect, be your advocate, who will say, look, no, this was bad that this was done to you. That for them to experience real outrage on your behalf after the fact, and to show that emotion that you've, or in my case, that I've bottled up or don't really have access to, is a very healing kind of thing. It really, you know, helps put, it's in my case, it's helped put me in touch with feelings I have and to kind of acknowledge them and incorporate them into my conscious assessment of who I am and where I've been, what I've been through and what made me the person I am today and what kind of person I'm going to choose to be going forward. And I hear echoes of that in Keith and Hemda's talking when, you know, when Hemda is outraged at some of the stuff that Keith's dad did to him when he was growing up, or when Keith makes his jokes, which is, you know, his way of expressing outrage in a real sense. When he makes jokes about Hemda being abused by the babysitter and her parents, you know, ignoring that or not dealing with that. They're just a good couple of people, and it's funny because they're the kind of people that, viewed from the outside, I could see myself not appreciating that aspect of their lives and who they are. And that's actually a common topic on the show, is Hemda talking about her friends not recognizing Keith's good qualities, you know, that at the clown agency that they both work for, the various agencies they work for, that Keith is the bad guy. Keith is the one that everybody's scared of on the job and, you know, that they don't like. And they talked about in the recent show, he'll do things and she'll do the exact same thing. And in her, it's okay. But when he does it, it's this horrible thing. And, you know, yeah, from the outside, you don't recognize what kind of person that person is. But in the context of an hourly, daily podcast where people are just talking honestly with each other, I don't think you can maintain a fiction that long, that effectively. I mean, I guess you could if you were being paid as part of a commercial radio experience. You know, you could adopt a persona and maintain it. But for free, I mean, why bother? You know, doing this thing as a hobby, you're going to do it because it means something to you. And it's really an authentic show. And the people are authentic. And I just enjoy it. Anyway, with all that talk about them, I'll go listen to them now. I'm going to wrap this one up. Thank you for listening. I'm John Callender, and this podcast is copyrighted and distributed under the Creative Commons license. See my website at www.lies.com/podcast for details. Talk to you next time.